Lampstand Press presents Weft History Audio, original material written by Scott Somerville, edited and read aloud by Nate Somerville, with color commentary provided by me, Ted the Thread,
and special appearances by Christina Somerville as Nellie the Needle.
Year 3, Week 1, President Adams' World. So let's dive into Tapestry of Grace Year 3. We're going to be spending the whole year on the 1800s, which are often called the 19th century. This week kicks off in year 1800, which was the last year of President John Adams' term in office. It's a great place to pick up the threads of history that we studied last year.
Hello, is this microphone on? Can anyone hear me? Hi, I'm Ted the Thread, here to tell you about all the fun parts of history, and to help Mr. Nate here explain the words that you might not understand. I'm mostly always right about everything, so you can believe anything that I tell you.
You should not believe hardly a word he says. He's my cousin. He's nearly always wrong about everything. My name is Nellie the Needle, and I'm here to help Mr. Nate keep Ted in line.
Actually, Nellie and Ted, you're both kids, and you're both still learning. It's a good thing to ask questions when you don't understand something. I'll do my best to explain things for you as we go along. Kids, if you're listening at home, Ted is a thread. And he comes up with a lot of crazy ideas. You should not do anything that he says unless your parents say that it's okay.
Hey, why are you telling them that? I come up with great ideas all the time. Like when I put peanut butter and jelly in my little brother's shoes yesterday.
Kids, if you're listening at home, you should never put peanut butter and jelly in anybody's shoes. You will get in trouble. And Ted will pretend like he never told you to do it.
Yeah, that's true. I will tell them that.
If you're going to put peanut butter and jelly in someone else's shoes, make sure you ask your mom or dad first. And then only put it into shoes that can be washed, like Crocs or sandals. You should never put peanut butter and jelly into sneakers or boots.
You know, I hate to admit it, but he does have a good point. Mommies already work hard enough without having to wash out sneakers or boots. You should only put peanut butter and jelly in Crocs or sandals. And then only with permission. It is funny, but we still have to follow the rules of our parents. If they say no, then you'll have to wait until you have your own kids, and then you can put peanut butter and jelly in their shoes. Ha ha!
Oh, I feel sorry for your kids already. As we talk about President Adams' world this week, we'll be learning about events in Europe and America. Europe was about one-third of the way through 20 years of warfare, which began with the French Revolution and its aftermath. Napoleon Bonaparte rose to power in the chaotic years after the French Reign of Terror in 1793, and became the first consul, or ruler, of France in 1799. Next week, we'll study Napoleon after he took over France. This week, we're going to flash back in time to the French Revolution that put him in power. The French Wars, from 1793 to 1815, were a big problem for American politicians. America's first president, George Washington, was careful to keep America out of Europe's wars. When his vice president, John Adams, won the election of 1796, he also tried to hold to that course. But Adams didn't have Washington's enormous personal prestige and popularity.
Wait a second. Prestige? Isn't that what magicians do at the end of their magic trick? Everybody loves a really cool magician. Does this mean that George Washington was a magician too? What was his stage name? Wait, let me guess. The Wonderful Wizard of Us, as in the United States. Ha ha!
No.
The Mesmerizing Magician of America.
No.
Greaticus Georgicus the Gesticulator.
Now you're just being silly. If you studied year two last year, then you'll remember that George Washington was the general who helped the colonies win the War of Independence, freeing them from England. And then, he was the first elected president. Washington had to work with everyone from all over the 13 colonies to win the war. Everybody loved Washington, but a lot of people despised Adams.
Aha! And why was that?
John Adams was a fiery politician from Boston, up in the north in New England. He didn't have a lot in common with the southern parts of the country, and he had a sharp tongue. That was good for the Revolution when he was speaking out against England. But when he argued with his fellow Americans, they didn't love him for it. America's political parties were rapidly taking shape. Many Federalists wanted America to take England's side in her wars with France. Thomas Jefferson was a Democrat Republican who used the French situation, the scandalous XYZ affair, and the controversial Alien and Sedition Acts to split the Federalist Party. Jefferson's beat Adams in the presidential election of 1800, and the Federalist Party never bounced back. The Federalists had made history, but now they were history.
Did somebody say controversy? Does this mean we don't have to do poetry this year?
Ted, I have bad news for you. There's going to be a lot of poetry this year.
Really?
Yep.
Rats!
As Christians, why should we study history? Each year, as we study history, we learn not only about the good things and the great inventions, but also about evil things. We're going to be talking about the terror of the French Revolution and about the bloodshed of the American Civil War. We're going to learn about slavery and how the westward expansion cost the Native Americans their lands and their ways of life. We're going to see how peoples around the world were conquered by European empires. And we'll study cultures that never knew God or the gospel. These things are enough to make anyone ask, do we really need to learn about all of this evil and wickedness? We're going to do our best in the coming weeks, as we learn about all these terrible things, to keep in clear view the fact that God is always good. Going all the way back to year one, when God took Joseph through kidnapping, slavery, being falsely accused, thrown into prison, and many years of being separated from his beloved father, Joseph knew, by the end of that story, that what men intended for evil, God intended for good. We studied the past to keep from repeating its mistakes. We studied the past to learn how we can do things better. And we studied the past to see the goodness of God in a fallen world. So the best reason for Christians to study history is to see the hand of God at work. God's wisdom, his mercy, his justice, his kindness, and his grace towards sinful people are on full display this year. Yet again, we'll see that the great question, who is Jesus, has many answers that the world gives us. But none of those answers are good answers, except for one. He is the Son of God. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He is our Savior from a world full of sadness and evil. What was happening in France was very important to understanding a lot of the things that were going on in America during this era. So let's take a quick look at what was going on over there. The French ancient regime began in the 14th century, and the kings of France grew in power until Louis XIV took the throne as an absolute monarch in 1642.
Wait, I always get confused when we talk about centuries because the dates in the book never match the century.
When historians talk about centuries, like the 12th, the 14th, or the 19th centuries, you're right, it can be confusing because none of those dates have 1200, 1400, or 1900, whatever, in them.
But why is it like that?
Because the historians are allied with the evil librarians. Haven't you read the Alcatraz books yet? Sheesh, you're never going to learn the truth if you believe everything that you read.
Ted, not everyone has read the Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarian books yet. And as funny as they are, I'm pretty sure that they're just a good story. So to answer Nellie's question,
seriously? That must mean you're a member of the Evil Librarians too. Ah!
And we just lost Ted. Back to you, Nellie. Everything is out of order because the first century was like the months leading up to a baby's first birthday. A baby is 0 years old, but they've still lived some amount of time. Logically, the first year of a baby's life, they are zero. And in the second year of their life, they are one. And so on and so forth.
So the 19th century will actually have all of its dates start with 18, like 1848. And the same thing will happen next century, 1948, but it's the 20th century? Like that?
Correct. The same thing will happen the next century. It'll be the 20th century, and all the dates will start with 1900, whatever. The simple trick to remember is to subtract 1 from whatever century you're talking about. So, if we say the 17th century, subtract 1, and all the dates will start with 1600. the 18th century is actually the 1700s. As Professor Ludwig von Drake once famously said, that's logic. It's going to get you into a lot of trouble, but it's logic. Going back to the French kings. In 1789, Louis XIV's great-great-great-grandson, Louis XVI, sat on the throne, still claiming absolute power.
Does this mean what I think it means?
Do you think it means that he was the boss and nobody could say no to him? Ever? Or they would be killed in a prison for disobeying?
No. I was thinking it meant that he was totally crazy and thought that he was one of those orange butterflies that flies thousands of miles every year.
Oh, you're thinking of monarch butterflies. Those are amazing creatures for sure. But monarch is from a combination of ancient Greek words. Monos, meaning only, and arc, meaning power, which when combined means one or only power. A king is the only power in his kingdom, at least in theory.
But this bathroom janitor guy was really the king?
Bathroom janitor guy?
Yeah, Louis. And everyone knows that the English call their bathrooms loo. So this was the guy who hung out in, or cleaned up, the bathrooms. The Louis guy.
How do you get things so completely wrong so much of the time, Ted?
Oh, it's a gift.
Louis is a French name, and it actually goes back all the way 1,000 years to the time of Charlemagne, which we studied last year. One of Charlemagne's sons was named Louis the Pious. He ruled the empire after his father's death.
Well, I mean, if you say so.
I do. It's right there in the history books. Louis XIV was not only king, but he truly did hold almost all the power, absolute power, and there was no one to disagree with him. Most kings don't actually have this much power, as we can see by the events of the French Revolution. Louis decided to support the American colonies and the revolution against his old enemy, England. But by the time that war ended in 1783, France had some serious war debts to pay. Unfortunately, the French tax system was neither fair nor flexible nor efficient. King Louis and his queen, Marie Antoinette, continued to live a glamorous and extravagant lifestyle designed to impress their court and the common people. But the commoners were groaning under a load of heavy taxes. Meanwhile, France was full of new philosophies from the Enlightenment, and the cultured critics of church and state were spreading new ideas of liberty, equality, and brotherhood.
Wait a second. What does this mean?
Well, liberty is freedom. Equality basically means fairness. And brotherhood means that everyone should help everyone, the way that you should help your brothers or sisters.
So, liberty means that I should be able to decide when I go to bed. Equality means that I should get half of Nellie's birthday cake. And brotherhood means that Nellie has to help me hide the crumbs so that you can't find them and get me into trouble. Ha ha!
No, not exactly. All of these factors added up to a volatile mix, and it only took a spark to lead to the French Revolution. In May of 1789, just after George Washington was inaugurated as America's first president, Louis XVI called the French legislature, the lawmakers, together to discuss the financial situation of France.
Inaugurated? Is this where we rate how much someone looks like a frog that got too fat and then got stuck in a log?
Other than the fact that aug rhymes with frog, I don't see where you're going with this.
Well, it says rated at the end and in at the beginning. And aug sounds like fat frog log if you smash the words all together. Wait, wait. Here comes Nellie. Let's both give her 9 points.
No, Ted. That is not very kind. We're supposed to encourage one another with our words. Inaugurated is a word for when someone begins their term of office, when they start a new job that they've been elected to. It has nothing to do with logs or frogs.
Hi, guys. Why are we talking about logs and frogs?
Oh, please let me tell her. Please, 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 please.
Just don't even ask, Nellie. And Ted, remember what I said about encouraging words.
Okay, fine. Nellie? You look nothing like a fat frog stuck in a log.
Why, thank you, Ted.
Sure thing. Hey, how was that, Mr. Nate? I mean, that was pretty good. Smooth, baby, smooth.
It's not exactly what I was hoping for, but I'll take it. You're a work in progress, Ted. This was a big deal. The legislature, called the Estates General, had not met since 1614, because the kings had claimed absolute authority. For 175 years, the French kings had not had to listen to their subjects. According to the law, French society consisted of three groups called estates. Members of the clergy made up the first estate, nobles the second estate, and the rest of the people the third estate. After 175 years, the French people had a lot of things that they wanted to say to their king, but he was not eager to listen to them. Many things happened over the next few years, but here are a few of the most important days that led to the fall of the French king and the murderous revolutionary regime that replaced him. And next week, we'll talk about the return to order under Napoleon's leadership. On June 10th, 1789, one branch of the Estates General, the one representing the common people, met at a tennis court and took an oath that they would not disband, that they would not go home, until they had created a constitution. They called themselves the National Assembly and went to work. Many historians point to this moment as the official start of the French Revolution. On July 11th, 1789, King Louis banished his finance minister, Jacques Necker, because he was friendly to the National Assembly. When the news reached Paris the next day, thousands of commoners gathered in protest. 3 days later, on July 14, 1789, an angry French mob stormed a medieval fortress in Paris called the Bastille. They tore it apart, looking for weapons and gunpowder. They also released the prisoners who were kept there and killed the jailer. The rest of France held its breath. It would seem King Louis must retaliate in force by sending his army. But instead, he tried to make peace with the common people. His plan failed, and from that point on, the National Assembly was the real power in France, not the king. 1789 was a busy year for France. Nothing very important happened, however, in the following year, 1790. And 1791 only saw one major change. Basically, the National Assembly passed laws forming a constitutional monarchy in which the king was supposed to share power with the Legislative Assembly. Things began picking up speed again in 1792.
Picking up speed? Are we having a race? Should I go get my jet-assisted scooter?
You have a jet-assisted scooter? Wait, why am I not surprised? Do you at least wear your helmet, Ted?
Yeah. All that safety stuff. Look, are we going to race or not?
Well, after 3 years of relatively minor changes, as the French king and the assembly tried to find a new balance of power, the last half of 1792, and then the years following, 1793 to 1799, that must have felt like a wild roller coaster to the French.
But, we're not gonna race? I mean, I've got my scooter and my helmet and a full load of jet fuel, which was not cheap, let me tell you.
No, you can put the scooter away. Just telling you about everything that's going to happen next should more than satisfy your need for thrills and danger. You can imagine yourself living in Paris and trying to survive everything that happened.
Okay, fine. We'll do it your way.
In August 1792, angry revolutionaries seized the royal family from their palace in Versailles and placed them under house arrest in Paris at the Tuileries. Until this point, the king had been treated with respect. But no longer. Now he was the prisoner of the mob, and you'll start to understand just how scary that was. In September of 1792, the mob in Paris, which was the capital city of France, executed over 1,000 prisoners in what was later called the September Massacres. A massacre is when a large number of people are killed all at once. These deaths were in response to a French military defeat as other European kings began to send their armies to try and rescue the King of France. The next year was 1793, and this is when the French Revolution plunged into open violence that would keep Europe at war for the next 20 years. First, since the king was in prison, the actual rulers of France were a group called the Committee of Public Safety. Under their orders, the king was executed in January of 1793, and then the queen was executed in October of 1793. Now France had no king at all, and the mob, made up of common people, were the only authority in the land. and the mob was very, very angry with the nobles for all the ways that they had suffered under the nobles' cruelty for hundreds of years. Throughout 1793 and into 1794, under a man named Maximilian Robespierre, the mob, which were led by a group of politicians known as Jacobins, guillotined thousands of suspicious people during the Reign of Terror.
So, Mr. Nate, what does guillotine mean?
The laws of France, which began in the Dark Ages, which we studied last year, used many savage and brutal means for executing people. The goal was not just to kill a person, but to make them suffer greatly while they died.
But that's horrible. How could they do that?
You need to remember that life was already pretty terrible for a lot of people. Without doctors, without medicine, without good food. Even for normal people, death came early and was often painful. They were used to suffering. So the rulers probably thought that executions for criminals needed to be even more horrible than usual, or else their subjects wouldn't have been afraid to die.
That doesn't sound like a very good reason to me.
Well, the French people agreed with you, and a French doctor named Guillotin said that they should have a way of killing people quickly, without pain. His solution, which was named after him, was the guillotine. Basically, it's a bench on which a person lies face down, and then a sharp, heavy blade is dropped down a set of rails, which chops off their head with one blow.
They cut off their heads?
Again, compared to what was done before this, the guillotine was quick and mostly painless. Having your head cut off with one blow was the way that nobles and kings chose to die. The French people were at least giving their victims a royal fate, which was probably the best that they could do at the time. Many of the people who were killed were political enemies who disagreed with Robespierre. They were not actually criminals who had broken any laws. Robespierre himself was executed in July of 1794. The French set up yet another form of government called the Directory, and two groups of lawmakers were given authority to make laws for France. These next 4 years, from 1795 to 1799, were characterized by corruption, financial problems, warfare with European neighbors, and strife among the leaders. Everything seemed to be going wrong for France. Meanwhile, back in America, George Washington retired after 2 terms of keeping America out of this mess. His vice president, John Adams, was chosen as president in the election of 1796. Adams' opponent was Thomas Jefferson, an ardent supporter of France. Jefferson got the second most votes in the Electoral College, and under the terms of the Constitution at that time, he became the vice president. America's elected leaders could not have been more visibly divided as to how to deal with events in Europe. As Americans, we should always be grateful for the fact that our founders were truly patriots who loved their country more than themselves. They were not perfect men. They fought and they argued, sometimes bitterly. One pair of men, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, even fought a duel over their quarrels, in which Hamilton was killed. But on the whole, unlike the murderous infighting of the French Revolution, where political opponents were often executed or driven into exile, American politicians were able to peacefully share power. Adams and Jefferson were opponents who greatly disagreed with one another, but their love for America was greater than their love for power. In 1799, the revolution came to a screeching halt as a new man took power. Napoleon Bonaparte deserves a timeline of his own, and we will cover him in more detail next week. For now, all you need to know is that France was sick of the constant chaos of the revolution. Napoleon offered order, and France took it. Although President Adams agreed with George Washington's decision to pursue a policy of neutrality in the war with France, neutrality is seldom a popular position.
What is neutrality, and why is it new? Is this that awesome video game where you get to ride on a giant frog while helping aliens destroy New York City? Oh man, I am so jealous.
Ted, I have bad news.
There isn't any video game where I get to ride giant frogs through the streets of New York City?
Yep.
What about aliens destroying New York City? That I get to help?
Nope.
Ah, I hate my life sometimes. Why do I even bother getting out of bed? If it weren't for your screams this morning when you stepped in the peanut butter and jelly that was in your shoes, I'd just give up.
Wait a second. That was you?
Nope. 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 I just like hearing you scream. It was probably Nellie who did that.
Uh-huh. I think we both know that Nellie does not put anything in anyone's shoes. So you need to not accuse her falsely. Going back to the original question, neutrality means that you don't take one side or the other. So if you and Nellie were fighting, for example, and I didn't help either one of you, I would be neutral.
What are you talking about? I never fight with Nellie. I can't help it if she's always wrong.
I am not always wrong. You're the one who is.
You know what? I'm just going to go over here and keep neutrally telling the story. You guys let me know when you're done. It seems like everybody else had a strong and opposing opinion regarding the American involvement with France. The Federalists, who were Adams' political party, disapproved of the French and the radical course of their revolution. Some even supported going to war against France. Many Federalists were accused of being war-hungry because they also wanted war with England, whose navy was consistently stopping and confiscating men and cargoes from neutral American ships.
Yeah, see? You keep saying that I'm confiscated, but these English Navy guys really take the cake.
Confiscated?
Yeah, you know how I keep getting everything right, but you tell me that it's wrong?
Oh, you mean confused. You keep getting confused. You think you're right, but you're wrong.
Yeah, confiscated, like you said.
No, no, no. Confiscated means to take something that someone should not have away from them. If your mom tells you that you can't have a lollipop or your sibling's toy, and then she finds you holding them, she's going to confiscate them. She'll take them away from you.
Toot sweet!
What?
Mom said I couldn't have any more toot sweets because the whistling always made her crazy. So she confused them, and now I don't have any.
She confiscated, not confused. You know what? Why am I even bothering? Okay. The Democratic Republicans, who were Thomas Jefferson's party, wanted to help the French revolutionaries and their struggle for liberty. They thought that Americans owed the French some help because the French helped America during the fight for independence. These Democratic Republicans were attacked by Adams and the Federalists for supporting the radical and bloody French Revolution across the sea.
Radical dude! Far out! Let's catch the waves, bruh!
Ted, why are you wearing swim trunks and sunglasses?
Well, Mr. Nate said radical, and that's what surfer dudes say. So, I figured we're going surfing. At last, we can go do something fun in the sun.
Actually, radical is a word used to describe something or someone that is strongly going in a different direction than the norm. In politics, a radical is someone with ideas that most people think are crazy.
So, basically, everything that I come up with is radical, right?
Well, I didn't want to be the one to say it, but if the shoe fits...
Yes! I'm king of the surfer dudes! Watch out, waves! Ted the Thread is ready to thrash!
And there goes Ted. Don't worry, he'll be back once he realizes that he can't swim. President Adams faced a serious threat of attacks from both the French and the English. France had declared war on Austria in 1792, and Prussia had joined Austria as an ally a few weeks later. In 1793, France had declared war on Britain. Meanwhile, Spain entered the war on the side of Austria and Prussia. So nearly every country in Europe was at war with someone else. As a result of these wars, both French and British ships stopped the neutral American ships and either seized their cargoes or pressed American sailors into their navies, or both. This really made a lot of Americans angry, especially the owners of merchant ships. Some of them wanted to fight the British, while others saw this as a reason to fight the French. Adams was seriously concerned that France might invade America, especially in 1799. He made ready by strengthening America's army, calling on George Washington to hold himself in readiness to serve once again as a general if he was needed. Adams also strengthened the navy, while actively sending diplomats to try and make peace with both England and France, at least peace with America. Adams was trying to steer a middle course. He didn't want to fight for or against France. In 1797, President Adams sent diplomats to France to try and negotiate a peace treaty, but the three French foreign ministers demanded that the Americans pay them a bribe before they would negotiate.
I know what negotiate means. It's what you tell your mom when she calls your sister or cousin to come and eat lunch, but they're still full from eating snacks.
No, that's not it at all. Why would you think that?
Listen carefully. Nah, which obviously means no or won't. Go, she ate. Negotiate.
You know, that actually makes more sense than usual for you, Ted. But negotiate means to try and come to an agreement, to talk things through until both sides agree.
Huh. Well, I think I like absolute monarchy better. There's none of this wishy-washy talky-talky stuff.
Well, only if you're an absolute monarch. Suppose that I said it's time for bed.
Well, then I'd say you're in a state of denial.
Yes, you would say that. But imagine that we've talked it through. You might ask to stay up for another hour. I would then say that if you did your homework reading, you could stay up. Then you might offer to practice reading aloud, which is like homework, but you want to read the latest Wings of Fire book because you love dragons. I would then agree, but only for half an hour.
Oh, so we're going to read about dragons now? Cool. Let me go get my dragon jammies.
No, no. That was just an example. The point is that we started with you wanting an hour of extra time, and I wanted you to do your homework. By negotiating, we talked to each other until we could agree on a middle path where each of us got part of what we wanted.
So can I have cookies and milk?
We'll negotiate about that later. Word got out about the demand for a bribe, and although the three French ministers were never identified by name, they were just known as X, Y, and Z. When the American citizens learned of the French insult to their ambassadors, many clamored for war with France. They were outraged because they rightly felt that they were being snubbed and humiliated, partly because their government had failed to aid the French revolutionaries. In an effort to hush all the mean things being said about President Adams and his foreign policy, the members of the Federalist Party, which controlled Congress, wrote and passed the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798. This was actually an illegal law, since the Constitution's First Amendment specifically allows people to speak freely. Among other things, these acts made it illegal to publicly criticize the government.
Wait a second. What is criticize? Is that when you grow big enough to move from a crib to a big kid bed?
Wouldn't that be cribicize?
Yeah, I guess you're right. So, what is criticize?
To criticize means to say how something or someone is wrong. It is often done in a mean way, so that people feel bad about what they're being criticized for. Like if you were to say that someone was too fat, or that they had smelly feet.
Hey, have I told you lately how your feet smell?
Are you going to criticize me kindly?
Like peanut butter and jelly.
Yep. Today, nearly 225 years later, it seems unthinkable to us that Congress would ever do exactly what the First Amendment forbids. We have been blessed with over 200 years of freedom to say what we think without the government stopping us. From the days of our great-great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers, we have been free to tell the government when we think it's doing the wrong thing. In 1798, however, many Americans considered criticism of the government to be treason, no matter what the Constitution might seem to say about it. There's an old Chinese curse that says, "May you live in interesting times." John Adams certainly lived through such times. First as a patriot leader during the Revolution, then as an American founder, and finally as the man who had to fill George Washington's presidential shoes. But perhaps the thing that we should remember him best for was the fact that he peacefully gave his political power, the position of president, to his political opponent. When we think about how many Frenchmen and Frenchwomen died in their struggle to seize and keep power, the Reign of Terror, this is no small miracle of God's grace to America. John Adams had already shown that he was willing to imprison people for speaking out against him while president. How easy would it have been for him to imprison or execute Thomas Jefferson, who became the next president, and with whom he had spent so many years arguing about politics? But instead, he followed George Washington's example and set the example for every other president of the United States. No matter how much we might disagree with the newly elected president, the peaceful transfer of power has continued in an unbroken chain to the present day. Even the Civil War, which we will study later this year, was not a case of presidential power struggle where one man sought to seize power from another. In the end, John Adams showed that he was a true patriot who loved his country more than himself.